On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
I'm really excited to welcome Liza Mundy, a New York Times bestselling author, to On the Bookshelf today. She was a longtime reporter at the Washington Post, contributed to numerous publications, including The Atlantic, Time, The New Republic, Slate, Mother Jones, and Politico, frequent commentator on prominent national TV shows, radio, and online news outlets, and a senior fellow at New America. Her book is a fascinating story called Code Girls, the untold story of the American women code breakers of World War II. It's from Hatchet Books. Liza, thanks so much for making time to talk to us on the Bookshelf today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And there was a PBS special, I want to say, called The Girl Computers or something like that, that was talking about code breaking in Great Britain. But we're talking about American women who were recruited by the Army and by the Navy intelligence to be code breakers during World War II.
Yes, that's exactly right. Many people have heard of the British code breaking operation in England, Bletchley Park, and many people also know that there were women working there. But in fact, our code breaking operation during the war was larger than England's and included more than 10,000 women, a really extraordinary number of women who were recruited to come to work in two very large but top-secret code-breaking compounds in the Washington, D.C. area.
So you did a great deal of research for the book, and you had the opportunity to talk to a few of the code girls who were still alive. And when you said something about classified, that's what made me think of this. They were reluctant even now to say certain words or to discuss their work because it was drilled into them. You do not, under any circumstances, talk to anybody anywhere. Nobody on the train, not even with each other. Nobody should know, nobody can know what you guys are doing. And they carried that with them. Some of these documents have only recently been declassified, right?
That's all correct, yes. I mean, they were told during the war, the Navy women were told that they would be shot if they talked about what they did during the war. It was top secret classified. Obviously, you don't want the enemy to know that you're breaking their codes because they'll stop using that code system. And then after the war, the women were told to continue to keep quiet. So in some cases, when I tracked down these women in their 90s, I had to persuade them that it was okay now to talk and that they wouldn't be put in prison if they finally told people what they did.
We've heard a lot about Rosie the Riveter type work, that women going into all kinds of manufacturing plants and taking on jobs that previously been held by men to free men up for combat. This certainly had that element to it, that every time that one of them got hired, it meant a guy who might have been hired would be sent off to serve in the military. It's not just a matter of, we'll just take a girl instead of a guy. These were women who were had special skills in mathematics or in engineering. They were in colleges for the most part, or they were school teachers. These are very smart women.
Yes, and you're exactly right in that I think people in general are aware that millions of women worked in factories and defense plants during the war. Rosie the Riveter is a collective name. But people are less aware that there were many, many thousands of women who worked in, who did essentially brain work, intelligence work, but also mathematics work and early computers. Obviously, my book is about women code breakers, and there were more than 10,000 of those, but these women were being hotly competed for by the military, by private industry. It's fascinating to look at the documents and to see how avid the competition suddenly was for college-educated women in the early 1940s, because before the war, the only job that a college graduate, a female college graduate, could reasonably expect was teaching school. And all of a sudden, they were needed to calculate weapons trajectories, to run computers, to break codes. It was just, it was a really a changed world.
When these women were recruited, they were never told up front what they were being recruited to do. Once again, keeping it so secret. And they hinted around, but never told them until they were actually involved in training the kind of work they were going to doing. Even when they were in training, they didn't even know then exactly what they were doing or why they were doing it.
as I said, the Army and the Navy were competing for these women, and the Army recruiting campaign was, it definitely played into incorrect stereotypes about what might motivate these women. The Army sent handsome young officers throughout the South, specifically recruiting female school teachers, and they wanted to encourage the notion in the women that they, if they came to Washington to do this top secret work that wasn't divulged to them, that they would make marriages and date and be able to go out with handsome young officers, as they were trying to play on the women's romantic sensibilities. But in fact, many of these hardworking school teachers signed up for the job because it paid more than teaching school, and of course they were patriotic and they wanted to serve the war effort, and they loved the idea of coming to Washington, and in some cases they were trying to get out of engagements because there was so much pressure on women to to get engaged before a man would ship out to war. And just as you said, meanwhile the U.S. Navy was competing, and they were mostly recruiting at first up and down the northeastern seaboard, the so-called Seven Sisters schools like Smith and Radcliffe and Wellesley, and those young women in their senior year would be invited in if they were particularly good in math or languages, and they would be asked, do you like crossword puzzles and are you engaged to be married? And just as you say, it wasn't until they gave the correct answer and actually be told what the work is that they would be training for.
The women were recruited by the Navy, which had two real big advantages. One of them was the Naval Reserve Act of 1916 that did not say a yeoman had to be a male. So there were women permitted to enlist in the Naval Reserves during World War One. You write. This gave them the opportunity to kind of build on a tradition at the beginning of World War II, but also they created a really stylish, good-looking uniform. And let's face it, one of the perks of being in the military, guys and gals want to look good when they're in their uniform. They want to look sharp. They want to look professional. And the Navy was wise enough to say, let's not make these drab and boring. Let's make them look good.
Yes, the great uniform debate was a major part of the Navy's decision, and in some cases reluctant decision, to actually admit women into the Navy. Just as you say, they had been admitted in very small numbers during World War II because of this loophole in the law that just didn't specify that a yeoman had to be male, so they were admitted as secretaries and clerks. But then Congress immediately closed that loophole after World War One. So in order to get a large number of women into the Navy in World War II, the waves were created, but there was this huge debate over uniforms, and reluctant admirals put up a big fight over things like they didn't want to let the women have navy blue, the navy blue color. They wanted them to have gray or tan, and the female deans and university professors who were fighting for the women's inclusion, they saw that this was important, and they pushed for the women to be allowed to have navy blue. But the Navy still wouldn't let the women have gold braid, which was sort of the trademark navy braid color. So again, some of the old admirals were reluctant, but once the women were admitted, just as you say, they hired a French-American fashion designer to come up with really, really stylish uniforms. And just as you say, men and women alike want to look good in their military uniforms. And it was very important to the women, and it did signal that they were being fully admitted into the Naval Reserves, and that the Navy cared about their appearance and ultimately making them feel pretty welcome.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Liza Mundy, who's the author of Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. It's from Hatchet Books. It's just loaded with the information about the more than 10,000 American women who participated in secret work for the Army and the Navy during World War II. There's a difference between a code and a cipher. And even though sometimes they were working on codes, more often they were working on ciphers. So what's the difference?
Yes, and sometimes they were working on both simultaneously.
Right.
So going back to our sort of initial conversation about Bletchley Park versus the American code-breaking operation, we worked with the British in the Atlantic on the German U-boats, but we were cooperating with the British to break the German U-boat codes. But we had sole responsibility for the Pacific Ocean, and that was, of course, a major, major part of World War II, and that's a vast, vast ocean, and we used code breaking to ascertain where the Japanese ships were going to be so that we could target them and sink them, and also to plan our amphibious invasions. So the Japanese used a code system is when a word or even a group of words is replaced by a unit. So a word like maru, which was the word for supply, which was supply ship, in Japanese, that would be replaced by a four-digit number group, like 6721. And that's a code. That's a code group. You replace a word with another word or even a set of letters. But a cipher is when each individual unit is replaced or scrambled. So the German U-boats used a machine called the Enigma machine, and anybody who's seen The Imitation Game is familiar with that. And that's a machine that essentially scrambles each individual letter. So a German U-boat message would be fed into the Enigma machine, and it had a set of rotors that would scramble each of those letters so that they would emerge as a completely different letter. The Japanese were using a code system. The Germans were using a cipher. But not to make things too complicated, the Japanese would often encipher their code systems by actually scrambling those numbers. So these were really complex systems, and there were hundreds of them. That's the important thing to understand, is this was a massive global war. Commanders had to communicate with troops that were thousands of miles away, or sailors that were thousands of miles away, and there were hundreds of code systems being used during the war.
The German Enigma machine eventually was broken, and it took a lot of people and some fortunate things that occurred. Enigma machines being captured on U-boats that were sinking, but were still salvaged partially, and things like that. That was critical for the Battle of the Atlantic, which for a long time was not going very well for the Allies. The German U-boats were sinking vast amounts of tonnage, which included troops, which included war material, which included food for Great Britain, which was desperate. The Japanese situation, it's different because their navy and army are spread over a much larger expanse, and so they're constantly communicating about, we're sending you reinforcements and so forth. The volume of messages that the Japanese were sending out, was that good for the code breakers, for the cipher breakers, or did that just make it that much more complicated?
It actually was good, and this is why they needed thousands of women to break these systems. You laid it out so well. It is good to have lots and lots of messages when you're trying to break into a system and figure out how it works, because that's called depth, and that's how you can tell the patterns. If you can compare lots and lots of messages, you can see that a certain code group might stand for Maru, or it might stand for the Japanese code for noon position, which was a really important message that in which a ship captain would radio where he was going to be at noon the next day. So they would look for that particular code group that told the noon position so they could get the intelligence out to an American submarine commander. So ironically enough, the more messages you have, the better your chances are of figuring out what certain code groups stand for. But it does mean that you need to have thousands of people working that message system.
Now, you mentioned in the book Code Girls that since the Japanese and the Germans were allies for most of the war, Japanese had access to the Enigma. There was also a Japanese military leader who was a big fan of the Nazis, and he wrote back lots and lots of information and descriptions of things, which apparently turned out to be enormously helpful for us when we were planning our Normandy invasion. He pretty much told us where everybody was and what they were good at doing.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that was actually a completely different system. You remember that I said that there were so many. And the Japanese had, it's true that the Japanese and the Germans, they actually modified an Enigma machine to use in some submarines that were actually making these massively long journeys between Germany and Japan. But the system that you're talking about was a really important system called Purple that was generated by a Japanese enciphering machine that nobody in the West had ever seen. And thanks largely to a woman named Genevieve Grochin, we were able to break into that system called Purple without ever having seen or captured a purple machine, and it was being used by Japanese diplomats who were palling around in Europe with Hitler and Mussolini and other Axis leaders. And just as you say, they were reporting their conversations in great volume, you know, very wordy diplomatic missives going back to Tokyo. And we were reading every one of those. And among the incredibly important intelligence we got was a description of the fortifications along the French coast, because some Japanese diplomats were taken on a tour of Hitler's emplacements, and they were talking about, you know, where the coast was really well defended and where it was not quite as well defended. And that's one really important factor in planning the D-Day landings to occur in Normandy.
We could hardly do any better if we'd sent our own reporter over there to do reconnaissance.
That's right. And of course, that's spying, right? So what we were doing during the war was trying to ramp up our intelligence gathering in every conceivable way. And we did build spy networks in France and in Germany, but that takes time to get mm-hmm. those in place. And being able to break the code systems was just so incredibly important. It was a more immediate way to get information once we broke into the systems.
One of the crypto analysts was Agnes Driscoll, and she was critical to the Battle of Midway, which changed the course of the war in the Pacific.
Yeah, Agnes Driscoll is so important. She actually came into the U.S. Navy in World War I, thanks to that loophole that we talked about. Mm-hmm. She came in as she started out as a stenographer, a secretary, but she was a genius. She had been a math teacher in Texas. She was also a musical genius and gifted in foreign languages. And even after the loophole was closed after World War I, she stayed on with the Navy as a civilian. And this was a time when code breaking was starting to be important, but it wasn't a prestigious naval career yet, and the men really didn't want it. So she sat at a desk in Washington and studied a captured code book and diagnosed how the major Japanese naval fleet code worked. She diagnosed that it was an enciphered code system in which the digits that stood for a particular word were then enciphered by adding another set of digits onto them. And it was thanks to her understanding of the system and then her training of male naval officers who would go out to Hawaii and work out of Pearl Harbor that we were able to anticipate the attempted Japanese ambush at Midway. And in fact, we were able to ambush the Japanese. This happened about 6 months after the disaster of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
It was payback for Pearl Harbor, and it was the beginning of the turning point in the Pacific War.
Right.
And it was thanks to male codebreakers, but it was thanks ultimately to Agnes Driscoll, who had diagnosed the system and who had trained these men.
Tell us a little bit about Dot Braden. She worked for Army Signal Intelligence Service. I had been a school teacher, and was a significant part of this effort.
Yes, so she's the central character in my book. There are a lot of women, you know, whose achievements are documented, but Dot is a person, and she's still alive, incidentally, and avidly signing books. She was a school teacher in Chatham, Virginia, not far from where I grew up, and she was overwhelmed by her teaching load. She was the oldest daughter in a family of four children. Her brothers were already in the Army, you know, as soon as the war started. And she was recruited by one of these handsome young Army officers. She signed up for a job. She didn't know what the job would be. She got on the train with her two small suitcases, just like thousands of other school teachers from all over the South. And she came to Washington, and within a matter of weeks, she was learning how to break the code systems that were basically controlling the movements of the supply ships that were supplying the Japanese army all around the Pacific. Just as you said, the Japanese had captured all these islands, they were in control of all these land masses, but all those army troops had to be supplied regularly with everything that they needed, food, water, medical supplies, reinforcements, and it was school teachers like Dot who were breaking the messages that enabled those supply ships to be sunk. And we sunk hundreds and hundreds and thousands of those ships to the point where most of the Japanese army deaths were the result of starvation or disease. It had a massive impact on the course of the war in the Pacific.
There was something else in your book that I had never heard of anywhere else, of course, because this is stuff that's just recently been declassified, and for some reason nobody else has written about it. I'm so delighted that you did. This was about work that was being done. These were Navy women who had been brought to Dayton, Ohio, to wire thousands of communicator wheels to go on the front of an American BOMBE machine. Is that bomb?
Yes, they were called bomb machines. Yeah, which is it's confusing. There's really no, people have ventured explanations for why they were called that, but there's not really a good explanation.
It's like tanks and jeeps. They just So they're making these components to go on this machine, which has fast spinning wheels, so that we're reverse engineering essentially a cipher machine that the Germans thought could never be built.
Right. The Germans thought that their Enigma machine cipher could never be broken. And the reason that they thought that was, as I said, they had these little Enigma machines, and they had so many of them in their U-boats, but also the German Army and the Air Force used them. It was a handy little portable device that would encipher German messages. It didn't have to be plugged in. It was battery powered. It was so efficient. But they overused it, for one thing. And they thought that we might be able to figure out how the Enigma machine worked. But they thought that we would never be able to break the key settings. The Enigma machine had a set of rotors that would scramble the letters, but the position of the rotors would be changed every day or every 2 days, and that was the key setting. And in fact, the British and then the Americans, when we got into the Battle of the Atlantic, we did build these enormous machines, and really their sole purpose was to break that key setting. And it was women in Dayton, Ohio, who were soldering and wiring the wheels that went on the front of these machines. And then the machines were brought in secret down to Washington, D.C. from Dayton, and the women were then brought to Washington, D.C. to run the machines and break the Enigma codes that allowed us to win the Battle of the Atlantic.
Wow. Now, there were two places in D.C., where women were working. The Navy was at Mount Vernon Seminary, and they had about 4,000 female codebreakers there. And Arlington Hall was where the Army had more than 7,000 workers, most of them female. But also at Arlington Hall, there was a unit that even fewer people knew about, and this was African-American women.
Yes, and this is very important because the Army during World War II was segregated, but there were African-American troops, men and women, serving in the U.S. Army, and there was an important code-breaking unit at the Army code-breaking operation. They were a segregated unit. They were top secret. It was mostly African-American school teachers, and they were working the codes and ciphers used by the private sector, because during the war, exactly as now, companies and banks enciphered or encrypted their communications. Because when we say cipher or encipher, basically what we're talking about is what today is called encryption.
Right.
So they were working the codes used by companies and banks to determine if there were American companies that were doing business with Japanese companies like Mitsubishi, which we weren't supposed to be doing, or even doing business with Hitler. So they were basically trying to determine if the allied private sector was doing business with the enemy. And that was a very important code-breaking effort as well.
I know we're running close on time, but I did want to talk about the fact that these are not machines. These are people and women who are learning things that in one sense they would rather not know. They're learning things like which American units are getting clobbered, which ships are being sunk. And since some of them did have, with over 10,000 women, there are bound to be some of them who had men that they loved who were serving in these two different theaters, and might even realize that someone they love was in harm's way, and here it is in something they've decrypted, and they realize, oh my gosh. And also, they know that by doing this work, they're leading directly to the death of enemy combatants. Some of them were able to say, well, this is war. They started it, we're finishing it, and that's that. But there was one lady named Jewel Bannister Esmacher, who, in retrospect, didn't have the same kind of attitude that she did during the war.
That's exactly right. And I would say that all these women had men they knew and men they loved who were in the fighting. I mean, you know, the phrase you see over and over again in the documents for World War II is total war.
Yeah.
It was total war. And every man who was of, you know, age and fitness had signed up for the fighting. So all these women had brothers and friends and fiancés and lovers and boyfriends or men they were corresponding with who they had never met. Because women were encouraged to do that, to keep up morale. So, and they felt very responsible for the lives of these men. And in some cases, they did break messages that told them what was going on with their brother's unit. Sometimes the news was good and said that the men were safe. One of the female codebreakers was able to tell her family that her brother's ship was safe, and she couldn't tell them how she knew. But another woman was the watch officer, the naval watch officer, when they broke a message saying that her brother's ship was about to be targeted by a kamikaze, and of course there was nothing they could do about that.
Yeah.
Although he did survive the raid, many of them didn't. There were other women who were decoding American military messages that contained casualty lists. So they were literally deciphering and then typing up and recording the casualty lists. And so even when we won amphibious landings or, you know, sea battles, they knew what the full costs of those victories were. And just as you say, there were women who broke messages that were directly responsible for the sinking of Japanese ships or entire convoys. And Jewel Esmacher, who is still alive, she lives in South Carolina. She was one of those school teachers who had been recruited. She knew that one of the messages that she broke led to the sinking of a convoy. And all the women, just as you say, felt very satisfied, you know, whenever that happened during the war, because just as you say, this was the enemy, and they had started it, and we were finishing it. But later on in her life, when she came to have a family of her own, she thought differently about the fact. It wasn't that she regretted it, but she came to fully appreciate that there were young Japanese men on, you know, on those convoys, and that there were Japanese families who lost their sons. So her reaction just became much deeper and more complex.
It's certainly understandable, and there were men that had the same kind of reactions. In the European theater, it was even more because these guys looked like a lot of our soldiers.
Right, absolutely. So it was, it was horrific and very complicated situation. But in the moment, all they wanted to do was to save lives and the war and bring the boys home.
I know there's a lot in the book that we just of which we barely scratched the surface, Liza. But it is so interesting, and it's wonderful. I did want to say that one of the things that I thought was interesting is that you got the scent of this story when you were working on the Venona, information on the Venona files, which has long been a fascinating topic that's interested me as kind of an amateur Cold War historian, as somebody who lived through the Cold War. So I just thought that was a very interesting tie-in.
That's great. And I'm glad that was interesting to you. And those, again, that system was mostly being worked by former Southern school teachers.
A lot of these women, because of the societal things, when the war was over, they go back home, they go to get married and be moms. That was kind of the expectations. My mom, who graduated from college in 1952, still lets people know, if they have any question about it, that she's a member of the AAUW. Even though she was a mom, she also had a college degree.
Well, she was one of a select few at that point because, it was the jobs were so scarce for women that families often wouldn't even pay a daughter's tuition. So the women who went to college during that era were very motivated to get an education.
They're extraordinary women. Liza, thank you so much for bringing their story to light. It's about time that we learned about them.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Once again, her website is lizamundy.com. That's LIZAMUNDY.com. The book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Code Breakers of World War II by Liza Mundy from Hatchet Books. Thanks for joining us for this very special show for American History Month. Be sure to check out the website WTBF.com and onthebookshelf.biz to hear archived interviews from On the Bookshelf. And also on my website, it has the text of book bits, the reviews. You can read those for yourself as well. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.